Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today, it's extreme grilling, techniques we'd never think of, from the romantic, like mussels roasted on a bed of pine needles, to the ridiculous, grilling a chicken while it's sitting on top of a beer can. Our guest is that king of the grill, the creator of the barbecue Bible, Stephen Raiklin. His newest book is Beer Can Chicken and 74 Other Offbeat Recipes for the Grill. Beer expert Steve Beaumont reports on the British beer renaissance that's starting up here in America. Novelist Jim Crace looks at the philosophical side of the crabapple. Then we check in with Seafood Watch at the Monterey Bay Aquarium to hear what's on their best bet list and what to avoid. And as always, in the second half of the show, we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern seem ready to roll. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, what have you been up to?
We have been eating biscuits in Conyers, Georgia, at a place called Mamie's Biscuits. We knew by the name that there was a particular food we ought to try there.
You know, it's biscuits really are an art form when you're in the South. Virtually every place you go, from a diner to a truck stop to a fancy restaurant, has biscuits, but the quality varies so much. And the art of making a great biscuit is to touch it as little as you can while still combining all the ingredients, which are, you know, very simple ingredients. You're talking about lard and flour and a little salt. At Mamie's, there is one woman who stands there for 10 hours at a stretch and hand makes these biscuits in full view of everybody, cuts them and bakes them.
She does not cut them. These are all hand, which is one of the things that makes them wonderful. Each one is slightly irregular. No two are alike. They're real scratch biscuits. And as Jane said, the ingredients are simply flour, buttermilk, and lard. But, you know, there's a certain touch in kneading the dough, forming the biscuit, that makes these unbelievably fluffy, flavorful, and yet sturdy enough to actually sandwich any kind of breakfast meat you want.
Now, my favorite thing to eat at Mamie's is a country ham biscuit, which is just this right out of the oven, big fluffy country biscuit split open with a piece of very rugged, salty, intense country ham that's been grilled on it, and it's heaven.
What else with the biscuits?
Well, as I said, any breakfast meat. My particular favorite is streak au lean, which is sort of like the ultimate bacon. You know, or I guess some people would call it salt pork, but it's a thick, crusty piece of pig meat that goes into the biscuit. You can also get these big biscuits split open and covered with, say, sausage gravy, or for that matter, a fried chicken, fried piece of chicken on top of the biscuit with a lot of gravy. But basically, breadstuffs are the things to eat there. They do serve lunch. It's a kind of meat and three affair. There might be, you know, barbecue or roast beef. But on the side of the meat, there is fabulous, fabulous cornbread made with pork cracklings.
And the biscuit goddess is a woman named Elnora, who has been there for umpteen years. Elnora stands quietly right behind the order counter with her forearms covered with flour and doesn't talk, very quiet woman. And if you ask her what the secret is, she just kind of shrugs her shoulder and said, I don't know, I've been doing it forever. She just has the lightest touch and is able to put the biscuits together the way an angel would. You know, I mean, just hardly touching them at all.
Well, what does the place look like?
Well, that's really one of the great bonuses about going to Mamie's, is that it's a tiny town cafe. Conyers is kind of it's way outside of Atlanta. I guess you could call it a suburb, but it's a small town. And inside Mamie's is the kind of quintessential small town breakfast place. There's one big round table that is constantly occupied all morning long by a changing cast of characters. They're the same characters every morning, but they come, they sit down, they have their biscuits, their coffee, they have a little chat, a little gossip, a little conversation. They get up and other people sit down, and this goes on all morning
long.
My
favorite in the ongoing cast of characters at Mamie's Biscuits is Miss Peggy, who is the town hairdresser. She looks like Dolly Parton. You will recognize her instantly. Her hair must be a foot
big,
and a half. Right. They say, you know, the higher the hair, the closer to God. Well, this woman is holy. She's got a big blonde do and long fingernails and amazing makeup. And she manages to sit there like a little queen and shovel in biscuits without getting gravy down the front of her dress.
Well, this sounds like it's going to be a great locale experience. All that pork, all those biscuits. Hey, thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
It's good for you.
Yes, it's health food.
Excuse me, please. Excuse me. But will you please pass the biscuits down, please? Will you pass the biscuits down, please? Excuse me, Uncle Bill. But will you please pass the biscuits, please?
Gene and Michael Stern's newest book is the update of their great classic, Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week, but you can get their Road Food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. You know, after hearing about those angelic biscuits at Mamie's, I have to tell you about the lightest, best tasting southern biscuit recipe we've tried. It's from food scientist and Georgia native Shirley Currier, and she calls them a touch of grace biscuits. You can find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Stephen Beaumont travels the world looking for exceptional beers. He shares his discoveries on his website, in his book, The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide, and with us here on The Splendid Table. Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn, and I'm just back from England today.
Oh, what were you doing in England?
I was drinking a style of beer called cask ale, or often called real ale over in England. And it's ale in almost its purest form.
What is the difference between a cask ale and the ale most of us might find, you know, in our local pub or bar?
Well, cask ale is the traditional type of British ale that you drink in the pubs. Normally, it's best bitter, but it can also be referred to as a pale ale or even some cask stronger ales. And what the cask part means is that this beer goes through its final fermentation in the cask from which it's going to be poured. And then when it's poured, there's no extra carbonation added. There's no gas pushing it through the lines like it is in a normal draft tap like we think of one. What they use is a pump called a beer engine, or often just referred to as a simple hand pump. And that pulls the beer out of the cask in a manner similar to a sump pump.
So what does this ale then taste like with this, not with the extra carbonation and all that other business?
Well, this is the beer that used to be referred to by returning American military men as the warm, flat beer of England. In point of fact, it wasn't really warm or flat. What it was cellar temperature as it should be served, just around, let's say, 50 degrees, 55 degrees Fahrenheit. And again, it's not really flat. It's just got a lower carbonation because it's not pushed through with these strong carbonated gases.
So can we get cask ale here in bottles?
Well, bottled cask ale is a different thing, really. We're talking about bottle conditioning then. That's the final fermentation in the bottle. But the good news is that more and more breweries in North America are making their own cask ales. So there's a little bit of an English renaissance going on across the United States. And this is one beer that the real beauty of it is you have to taste it fresh and you have to taste it at the pub. So you don't really drink cask ale at home. You go to places like in San Francisco, there's a wonderful bar called the Toronado. that has a couple of casks always on tap. In Denver, there's a place I like a lot called the Falling Rock. They have three beer engines on the go at all times. There's a Map Room in Chicago, DBA in New York, more and more, just these pubs popping up all over the place that want to serve this really interesting ale of British tradition.
So there's a range of flavors, though, you're saying. So is there one profile of what a cask ale is going to taste like?
No, because cask really refers more to the way that the beer is fermented and poured at the pub rather than the style of beer. However, what you most often find on tap or on cask is best bitter. And best bitter is, again, this is an English term. It doesn't mean that it's really bitter, but it does mean that it has a decent amount of hops to it, which contribute bitterness to the beer. And usually a lower carbonation level because of that cask delivery, and a slightly lower alcohol level. This is what the British call a session ale, which means that they can sit at the pub and have a few pints in a drinking session and still be able to walk home.
One last question. Are the casks wood or are they metal?
At one time, they were all wood, but most often now you do see metal casks. They have to be properly outfitted for cask fermentation because there's a whole process of cellarmanship that involves making sure that the fermentation at the pub goes off properly, making sure that the cask is well ventilated, et cetera, et cetera. There are a few breweries, again, mostly in the United States now, that are doing some interesting cask fermentations, though. So sometimes you'll see a cask ale appear that's been sitting in bourbon wood or something. It'll have a little bourbon-y character to it or something like that. So you do see that from time to time.
Well, it sounds like some sessions are in order.
Absolutely.
Steve, thank you.
Cheers.
Stephen Beaumont is the author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide. You can find his list of where to drink cask ale on our website, splendidtable.org. And one other thing, while you're there, check out the Splendid Table store. It's a collection of some of my favorite finds. I have taste tested everything on the site, and there is a great gift for Mother's Day as well. It's a brunch in a basket, and it involves this chocolate cherry bread that is studded with chunks of bittersweet chocolate. And I am not going to say another word. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, beer can chicken and other offbeat grilling ideas, crabapple psychology, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. When you look at where cookbook author Stephen Raiklin started out, you'd never guess where he'd end up. Stephen earned the coveted Grand Diplôme at La Varenne Cooking School in Paris. He went on to teach classical French techniques in France and America, and from there he started writing about healthy eating. Then something happened. French-trained Stephen began trekking around the world studying barbecuing and grilling. He wrote the now classic Barbecue Bible. Well, his latest book is taking all of this totally over the top. It is called Beer Can Chicken and 74 Other Offbeat Recipes for the Grill. Stephen, welcome.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Okay, Steve, come on. What's a classically trained French chef doing cooking with a beer can?
Well, you know, I saw this dish actually at the Memphis in May International Barbecue Cook-Off about half dozen years ago, and I fell in love with it. And I fell in love with it, first of all, because it looks so wacky, and second of all, because it makes absolutely the best roast chicken you can imagine. And for those of your listeners who may not be familiar with beer can chicken, what you do is you open a can of beer and you drink half. This is very important. And then you insert the chicken. You position the chicken in an upright, so it's kind of standing on its end, and you insert the beer can in the cavity of the chicken. You pull its little legs forward so it stands upright. And you indirect grill or roast the chicken. You can roast it in the oven in this undignified position. Now, when you do that, three things happen. First of all, the beer starts steaming and boiling inside the can, so the chicken steams from the inside out. Second of all, because the chicken is in an upright position, it roasts 365 degrees, so the skin gets really crisp. And third of all the fat melts out of the skin, so you wind up with an exceptionally moist, crisp bird that's a little less fatty than you would have with a conventional roast chicken. It's a great conversation piece. It gives you everything you could want in poultry. And, of course, when I saw that, I mean, I thought, you know, the French be damned. I mean, we have to do beer can chicken.
Okay, so you can do this on the grill, you're saying?
Yes, it's traditionally done on the grill. You use the indirect method, and that means that if you're working on charcoal, your coals are raked into two piles on the sides, the chicken cooks in the center. Or if you're working on a gas grill, you'd light one side and you'd cook the chicken on the other side. The idea of using a grill as opposed to the oven is you can toss some wood chips on the coals and create some wood smoke, which adds another dimension of flavor to the chicken.
You've got a ton of recipes in this book. Now, you've also got ones where you cook over Coca-Cola.
I like to say that this is a serious look at a lighthearted subject. I truly do believe from the bottom of my heart that beer canning is the best way to cook a chicken. So then I thought, well, let's take this idea and see how far we can go with it. So first of all, I mean, I went through all the beers, domestic and imported, and then I went through other drinks that come in cans, right? Like there's a cranberry juice chicken, there's a lemonade chicken, there's an iced tea chicken with an iced tea barbecue sauce, I might add. And then I thought, well, okay, I mean, kind of we've done the chicken thing. So what other poultry can we do? I spied one of those little 6-ounce cans of pineapple juice, and I thought, boy, that's just designed for quail, right? So we have a pineapple juice can quail. And then, I saw a can of Orange Crush, and I thought, duckling à l'orange. I used to make that in Paris. So let's do a bubba version of duckling à l'orange. And even the turkey does not escape this indignity, because there's the Foster's Ale Company of Australia makes a 32-ounce can of beer. It's sort of colloquially known as the oil can, and that is just the right size for beer canning a 12-pound turkey.
Okay, now I know what to do with the big cans. But you also branched out to beef?
Well, we've taken up half a book doing these wacky things with chickens. So I thought, all right, what are some other wacky things we can do on the grill? And my first thought was beef. You know, there's a restaurant in Providence, Rhode Island, where they take the steaks and they actually throw it right on the coals. It's called dirty steak, where you grill the steak right on the embers. And then using that as a jumping off point, I have one version where you wrap a steak in hay and you grill it so the hay catches fire and kind of smokes the beef.
That sounds delicious. That really sounds great.
Yeah. It's absolutely fabulous.
Okay, there's two things, though, how do you do them is my big question. Mm-hmm. One is mussels under pine needles.
Ah, this is a traditional dish in the Bordeaux region, which is called moule éclade. Éclade comes from the word éclore, to open. And what I'm told you're meant to do is you bury mussels under a pile of dry pine needles and set them on fire. Now, like many things picturesque in French, it sounds great, but it doesn't work because you don't get enough heat from the pine needles. However, I was intrigued enough with the idea of pine needle cooking to try doing it on the grill. And in fact, if you use your grill to boost the heat, you can catch the pine needles on fire, and then you get this wonderful sort of piney smoke that mingles with the mussel juices. So that's kind of my variation on a classic French recipe.
I can picture the pine scent. It could be great with something like mussels.
It's absolutely fabulous because, you know, mussels have that sort of briny succulence and sweetness, and then you bring in the aromatic smoke from the pine needles.
Yeah.
And, you know, plus it just looks cool as all get out. And that's really what we're talking about here.
We want things, you're saying you really want things that people are going to stop and look at and go, ooh, and all of that business.
I do, but I also want things to taste great, you know, and so that's kind of the final arbiter. Just to tell you about a couple other ones that are fun, there's the Grillmaster breakfast. Did you see that one?
Remind me.
Yeah, well, you take two oranges and you squeeze the juice out of them, and into two of the hollowed orange halves you put scrambled eggs, and into the other two hollowed orange halves you put biscuit batter, and then you indirect grill those on your grill, so it sort of brings barbecue into the breakfast mode. Then let's see, there's a you'll appreciate this one. There's the mozzarella s'more. Remember the s'more?
Mm-hmm,
yeah, where you take a marshmallow and you put it between two graham crackers.
Right.
Well, in this version, you roast a little mozzarella bocconcini at the end of a skewer.
A little
and you
ball.
Sandwich it. Yeah, and you sandwich it between two pieces of grilled bread, and the melted chocolate becomes a sun-dried tomato, you know, so it even looks kind of like the traditional s'more.
I got to know about one other one. Grilled eggs.
Yeah, grilled eggs. Well, hey, push the envelope. That's what I always say. This is actually a traditional barbecue dish you find in Southeast Asia. I first saw it in Vietnam. I've also seen it in Thailand and Indonesia. You take an egg and you put it on the grill, and by working over a moderate heat, you can actually roast the egg in the shell over the fire. You get a completely different flavor than a hard-boiled egg. And in keeping with the Southeast Asian mode, I call for the egg to be shelled and sliced and served with mint leaves and basil leaves and chilies, wrapped in lettuce leaves and dipped in a Thai fish sauce style dipping sauce.
I'm lighting the grill, Stephen. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lynn, and I appreciate your taking a lighthearted look, a serious look at a lighthearted subject.
Stephen Raiklin is author of Beer Can Chicken and 74 Other Offbeat Recipes for the Grill. Now, you can get his recipe for basic beer can chicken on our website, splendidtable.org. We test drove this recipe this week, and trust me, it sails. British author Jim Crace likes to write about the smaller psychological moments in life. In his collection of short stories, The Devil's Larder, he writes about sipping hot soup in the cold winter air, bad breath in the workplace, and the mystique of the crab apple.
If those children had been mine, I would have shouted out and stopped them. But they were strangers, only passing through, and I was irritated. So I stood and watched. They'd find out soon enough. The family had pulled their car into my field, as if the farmland had been set aside for picnickers. Their mum and dad had spread their blankets in the shade of our horse pine, with its inviting mattress of orange needles, and sent the children off across my land to stretch their legs. I've seen it all before, a dozen times. What child of five or six, as these two seem to be, would not be drawn to our fine crab? In every way but one, it is a grander tree, dramatic and more showy than any of its sweeter apple cousins on the farm. That day, as he and she, in all their innocence, went hand in hand across the field, the fruit was at its best, in clumps as tightly packed as berry strigs, and ripening unevenly on its crimson pedicels, through all the blushing harvest colours, yellow and orange to purple red. My crabs are vagrant, seeded more than 30 years ago by some rogue animal, no doubt, and not put there, as all the creaky grandads claim, by a bolt of lightning souring ground where lovers from opposing villages were kissing. That's why the fruit is bitter, they say, and that explains the blush. To these two youngsters, as they reached the crab, it must have seemed they'd found a magic tree, with all the warmer tints and shades of a paint box, or Christmas-coloured lights, or some exaggerated textile print, and with such low branches that all they had to do was help themselves. I watched them reach up to the lowest fruit and hesitate, a warning trapped behind my teeth. At first they touched, but did not pick. This surely must be theft. Such tempting treats could not be free. Besides, they were not sure what kind of fruit it was. They'd not seen these on supermarket stands or in their gardens. At last they pulled the fruit down from the tree. Here was their perfect contribution to the family picnic. Their harvest would, they knew, be irresistible. But first, of course, they each rubbed an apple against their clothes to get a shine, and, almost at my silent prompting, tasted it. My mouth was watering. I saw the children shake their heads and spit. They'd never pass a crab again without their unforgetting mouths flooding with distaste. I did not stay to watch their picnicking. There's always work to do. But I imagine that when they sat cross-legged on their fine blankets beneath the pine while Mum and Dad dished out a harmless meal from plastic containers, tin foil and flasks, the children brought the food up to their mouths with just a touch of fear and half a glance towards the tree that had betrayed their hopes. Here was a lesson never to be forgotten about false claims and bitterness and trespassing.
Jim Crace is author of The Devil's Larder. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We've got Sam on the line. So, Sam, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. My question is two parts. I've been eating egg white omelets for the past several months for the health benefits, and I enjoy them quite a bit. But what I have is this excess of egg yolks.
I can picture this. Yeah, probably quite a few, right?
Yes, and I wanted to know how I should be saving them and what I've been doing, what's the best way to save them. Also, what I've been doing is, on the weekends, making key lime pies out of these egg yolks, which are excellent. I don't know if that's defeating the purpose of eating the egg whites all week long, but it's a nice balance.
I would never knock key lime pie.
Okay.
The best way to store egg yolks, if you have to keep them a long time, is mix them with a small amount of water.
Oh.
Yeah, because it helps keep them from forming a skin.
Mm-hmm.
And put them in containers, small containers, and freeze them. But what you want to do is mark how many egg yolks. You know, so if it's four egg yolks, just mark four large egg yolks.
Sure.
And they'll keep 3 to 4 months in the freezer.
Should I beat them before I freeze them?
By adding the water, you can do the water two ways. You can just have the whole egg yolks in a container, and then just very gently pour in a little bit of water just to moisten the top of them. Or you can stir them and then put a little water in.
Okay.
And you know, some people don't bother with the water, but I found sometimes when I defrost them, they've got a skin on them. You know, and I don't like that. And you know, as far as using them, you're making key lime pie. That's a custard. And, of course, egg yolks are great for custard. But they're also good as an enrichment or as a glaze. You know, for instance, you could be wanting to roast, let's say, a chicken.
Sure.
Well, you could mix egg yolk with a little saffron.
Oh, yeah.
And salt and pepper and brush that onto the skin of the chicken. It's going to give it a little golden glow. You know, do it maybe the last half hour of roasting or so.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you can be very esoteric about all this, because in the 16th century, that was called enduring, or to enrobe something in gold.
Well.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Isn't that elegant and delicate?
Yes.
So this is how you get sort of your egg yolks, and you eat them too.
Perfect.
But not necessarily in large quantities. So, hey, thanks. Great question.
Hey, thanks so much. Enjoy the show.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Egg yolks, by the way, are binders. It's the way you hold things together. So this is why, for instance, you'll find egg yolks often used in salad dressings or in things like mayonnaise. Now, of course, nowadays with the problems of salmonella, you want to heat an egg yolk up to about 160 degrees. And one way you do that, if let's say you want to make a dressing with them or some homemade mayonnaise, is you do mix it with a little bit of water. And you keep stirring it and stirring it in a small saucepan over medium heat. And have one of those instant reading thermometers, okay? And as soon as it reaches 160, it's still going to be creamy. You throw it in a blender, you whirl it around, add some lemon juice, add a little bit of mustard, and then slowly start drizzling in oil. And you'll have homemade mayonnaise. And it'll keep 4 or 5 days in the fridge. And it is so good, I cannot tell you. The only problem is you tend to eat it with a spoon. But that's another issue. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. We've got Jim calling. So, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Lynn. A neighbor brought us fresh leeks straight from her garden to our kitchen.
Ooh.
A nice, generous mess of them, maybe a dozen medium size and a half dozen slender ones.
Uh-huh.
And I know some things to do with the leeks, but I wondered what you would do with perfectly fresh ones.
Oh, you know the first thing I'd do? I would get a big, tall container. Right?
Uh-huh.
And I put them in it so that... Are the tops gorgeous? The green tops?
The tops are intact.
They're all intact and they're... Yep. Are they really pretty? You know, straight and whatever and fresh?
Yep.
I'd have a party and I'd use them as the decoration on the table. They are the most... I used to do this when I lived in a place where leeks were really cheap.
Uh-huh.
We used to do this in the spring for dinner parties. You know, you'd have a sideboard or a table or whatever, right. And we just do this big bouquet of leeks with a little water in the bottom so that their roots are sucking up water.
Uh-huh.
And then the next day I'd cook them. Or put half of them out for decoration and the other half you'd cook. I'm very serious because it's so rare you ever, ever see leeks in this condition unless you grow them yourself.
Uh-huh.
And as far as cooking them, one of my favorite ways of doing them is you clean them, you know, take off the root and slit them down the center to get some of the sand out. And then I sear them very lightly in a combination of olive oil, butter, and a little bit of good bacon.
Uh-huh.
Again, not a lot of fat, but three fats that deliver so much flavor, you cannot go wrong. And then sprinkle them with a little white wine and broth and let them cook a little bit. And then just serve them barely warmed. You know, and you can do them ahead, because if you let them sit in the fridge in that mixture, they just get better. And then, you know, bring them out and warm them up in a casserole in the oven.
Sounds great.
The other thing is you can slice them and sauté them, but make a big pile of them, and then pile them on a plate and serve some kind of sweet-tasting shellfish on top of them. So, you know, sautéed scallops, if you're splurging, a lobster,
uh-huh.
Something like that.
Yeah, or, I like seafood a lot, and that sounds wonderful.
And leeks and seafood. Oh, you know, combination made in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd throw a party and make them the decoration. People always give them a second look. They're gorgeous, and then the next day you cook with them.
Well, that does sound like fun.
And I envy you, your neighbor. I wish somebody would bring me a big mess of leeks. Jim, thanks for a good question.
Okay, thank you for the answer. Bye now.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for our weekly food challenge. Now, this week's question is, what food takes its name from one of the most embarrassing events in Sweden's history? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be getting back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to get back to your calls in a moment. And by the way, the number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia query. Now, the question was, what food takes its name from one of the most embarrassing events in Sweden's history? It is the Wasa brand rye cracker. You know those whole grain crackers from Sweden with the picture of a ship on the label? Now, why people would name something for one of their country's greatest snafus, I cannot understand. Here's the story. The Wasa was a warship that was built by the Swedish Navy in the 1600s. Now, the aim was to make it the most powerful fighting ship in the world. Somebody, possibly the king, decided it had to be tall enough to be seen over all other ships. And so it was. So the big day arrived. The Wasa was launched. It sailed for about maybe 15 minutes down Stockholm's harbor. A puff of wind came along. It keeled over and it sunk like a stone. It was too top heavy. Well, back in the 70s, the Swedes raised the ship, and you can visit it if you go to Stockholm. But now let's get to those rye crackers. Those rye crackers are one of the great hallmark breads of Sweden. The idea is that you bake them in the fall from the new grain, and you can keep them all through the winter. In fact, a lot of times they're baked as big flat rounds with holes in them, and you string them on poles, and you just hang them from the ceiling in the house, and you break off what you need. Now, if you want some great Scandinavian bread recipes, go to any book by an author named Beatrice O. Chikangas, okay? She is the master of Scandinavian baking. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. And we've got Lisa waiting patiently. So, Lisa, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I would like to make a rollout cookie, in other words, a cutout cookie, but with cheese in it.
Oh, you mean like a cookie that's not sweet, but savory?
Yes, exactly. And well, I have three questions about that.
You're very organized, Lisa. I like this. Go ahead. Go ahead, woman.
I am wondering, since cheese and butter are both fats, if it would be a direct replacement, one for the other, grated cheese for equal quantity of butter.
Okay.
I'm wondering if I would leave in the sugar or just take out some of it.
Uh-huh.
And finally, if I'm taking, well, there are two others. If I'm taking out some of the sugar, must I add more flour? And then finally, would I change the baking time?
These are all excellent questions. I feel like I want to put on my science hat. Okay, so the challenge here is taking a sweet, essentially a sweet cookie recipe and turning it into a savory one.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to give you guesswork because I really don't know the science of this, but the first thing I think you want to do is I could cut back a little bit on the butter if you're using a high-fat cheese. You know what
okay.
I'm saying? If you're using a very lean cheese, no. But you could cut back a little bit if you're using a cheddar or a Parmigiano Reggiano. What kind of cheese are you thinking about?
I'm thinking of a Monterey Jack.
If it's a strong Monterey Jack.
Okay.
Because the other thing is, a really mild cheese gets lost in baking.
True.
It sort of flattens out in baking. So you want something that has a lot of character. I think what you might want to think about is cut back on maybe a quarter of the butter.
Okay.
And add the cheese.
And
add an equal amount of cheese. I mean, be generous with that cheese. Then the next thing is I'd keep a tad of the sugar. Let's say a recipe calls for 2 cups of flour, a cup of, a stick of butter. I'd throw in another cup or more of grated cheese. I'd keep 2 or 3 tablespoons of sugar.
Okay.
I'd up the salt.
Aha.
Yeah.
You know, there might be salt in the cheese.
Yeah, but I think I'd still up the salt. I'd double up the salt because you want to have a salty backdrop to the cookie. And then, I mean, for instance, there are things like rosemary shortbread out there. I mean, where you take a basic buttery cookie recipe and you throw herbs in it and cut back on the butter. But what I would also add is some black pepper. Wouldn't that be nice?
Mm-hmm.
And does that cover all your questions? I'm not tracking.
Oh, let's see. Do we need to add more flour if we're taking out some sugar?
I don't think so.
Okay, and do we need to change the baking time?
I think that you're going to have to feel your way, but I don't think the baking time is going to change radically.
Well, this is going to be fun. I'll play with it, and I'll let you know if
it works. Play with it, and the only thing is, it's you may want to add a tad more flour because you have more fat.
Mm-hmm, that's what I'm wondering.
But you don't want to add too much. You want these to be melting in the mouth, right? I mean, you don't want them to be chewy and tough.
True, so that we'll just play with that, and I may have to make it a couple of batches before it comes out right.
You may have to, and you may have to send some to us to taste, and we may all have to try it together.
Excellent idea.
I think it's a great idea. It's great fun to do this.
Oh, I appreciate your advice, and I really enjoy the show.
Well, thanks, Lisa, and thanks for a great question.
Thanks, Lisa. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. This idea of taking a sweet recipe and turning it into a savory one, let me flip it over for you. Do you know you can take any biscuit recipe out there and add about a quarter to a half a cup of sugar to it and any kind of sweet spice that you like? And I always throw in extra butter. And just pat it out, and you can turn it into something like an apple cake, for instance. Just take cut up apples, toss them with spices and sugar, and press them in. Or peaches, or whatever is in season. The idea is you suddenly have what is called a sweet shortbread. So it's this idea, start out with one thing, make it something completely different. Speaking of baking, I have to give you an update. Straight from the World Cup of Baking in Paris. Now, this is the Olympics for professional bread bakers. Remember a while back we talked with the coach of the American team? They were heading to Paris to defend their title as world champions. Well, they messaged us this week to tell us they took the silver. They were beaten out by the Japanese contingent, and Belgium took third. Sadly, the French didn't even place. Sometimes it just makes you wonder, doesn't it? Okay, back to the phones. We've got Clark waiting. So, Clark, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have a sort of embarrassing question, and it's embarrassing because I thought this was going to be really easy to learn how to make, and I haven't had very good luck so far. And to add insult to injury, whenever I go down to the local diner or a truck stop, I find that they do it very well.
Don't be embarrassed. This kind of thing, you're describing the state I've lived in for years. So but what are you talking about?
The question is how to make really good hash browns. Because I've had just terrible luck where in the best cases they come out nice and crisp on the outside, but they're still gooey and nasty on the inside. And in the worst case, they're just gooey and a big blob of potato.
All right, let me give you a basic primer, and this may help. One of the reasons I think why hash browns are so good in the diners and the truck stops and the greasy spoons is they're using leftover potato, and it's already cooked. Generally, the best kind of potato for this is a potato you'd use to make potato salad, you know, something like one of the redskin potatoes. They'll call them waxy potatoes. They'll call them boiling potatoes, but redskins, yellow fins, even Yukon golds, those white new potatoes, they don't have a lot of starch in them. So first of all, the potato is pre-cooked, and usually it's been sitting around, so it's sort of been in the fridge for a day or so. That's number one. The other reason why I think they do such a great job is they use plenty of fat. And often they're doing them on a big griddle, you know, where they do the burgers or the eggs. So they've got plenty of room to get crisp, because if you crowd a pan when you're trying to brown something, it doesn't brown. It kind of steams. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you how I like to do them. All right. This may not be perfect, but maybe this will help you. I boil up potatoes a day or so ahead. I leave the skin on. When I can pierce them with a knife, but there's a little bit of resistance, I drain them, rinse them with cold water, and I put them in a bag and I put them in the refrigerator. When I want to make the hash browns, I sometimes don't even bother peeling them. I cut them into maybe, 3/4 inch dice, let's say. And then I take a really good tasting fat. It might be bacon fat, which is really traditional. It might be olive oil. It might be a mix of something like a vegetable oil with a little bit of bacon fat just for flavor. And I take a big skillet that I can get really hot. I film the bottom of it with oil. I chop up some onion and maybe some garlic. Some people like, you know, peppers in there, like, you know, red pepper or whatever. But I like onion and a little bit of garlic and maybe some bacon bits. And I get the pan pretty hot and I drop in the potatoes and the onions and I salt and pepper them right away. And then I use a pancake turner. to keep turning them. So I try to dig up the crust as I turn them so they don't get separated from the crust. And I do them pretty quick, medium-high heat to high heat, depending on your stove. And if you got a big old black skillet, it's the perfect thing. But you can do it in any good sauté pan. And I want all the crusty bits in the pan. That's the thing that's so good about them. And that's it. That's how I do them. So why don't you try that and see how it works for you?
Great.
All right.
One other question is sometimes you see them in the fry cooks put a heavy, you know, some sort of metal press on top of it to press them down.
You can do that too. I mean, you can put another pan on top of them and put some cans in it. That's just to help crisp them.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to do that, don't leave them on too long. They'll burn. But the idea is give them plenty of room to brown. Don't pile them in the pan.
Okay. Wonderful.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you very much.
A good question. It's something a lot of people probably want to try. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. From time to time, we check in with the Seafood Watch program at California's Monterey Bay Aquarium. This is about ocean conservation. They check with sources around the world to find which fish are being overfished or are being raised in ways that damage the environment. We have on the phone Jennifer Dianto. Now, she is the program manager of Seafood Watch. Jennifer, thanks for taking time to talk to us.
No problem. It's nice to be here. Thanks.
So, Jennifer, what's on your list of best choices? What are a couple of choices that you want to tell us about?
There are some great choices, some great sustainable environmental fisheries and fish farms that are operating out there that provide a great product, such as catfish, lots of farm-raised shellfish, such as oysters and mussels. And there are some great shrimp products out there for us as well that are trapped caught in a sustainable way.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, what I mean by sustainable is that they're caught or farm-raised in a way that is not doing any damage to the population, meaning they're not overfishing, taking these fish faster from the natural environment than they can naturally replenish themselves. They're not catching other species like marine mammals and endangered sea turtles and juvenile species and sharks. And they're not damaging the surrounding ecosystem or the habitat.
Okay, so shrimp is generally okay, and shellfish, and you're saying catfish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I want to reiterate on shrimp, that's the beauty of our program. We really try to find those fisheries that are more sustainable. For example, not all shrimp is great. We do have some shrimp on the avoid list, and that would be international wild-caught shrimp or farm-raised shrimp, and that's because we don't feel the management is up to par. However, our U.S. wild-caught shrimp or trap-caught shrimp, they're well-managed. That means scientists and resource managers are really regulating those fisheries to make sure that there's not many adverse impacts to the environment.
Okay, so when we go to the fish market, we have to ask.
Yeah. It's the program's really about asking questions and being comfortable with asking questions about the seafood that you're getting.
Now, you focus on what is good for the environment and what is good for the fish. What about the avoids? Do you have some prime things we should be avoiding?
Yeah, there are a few out there that are actually pretty misleading to the consumer. A lot of folks go out and they get this great fresh Atlantic salmon. And unfortunately, there is no longer a commercial fishery for Atlantic salmon along our coast. In fact, what you're getting is a farmed product. And there are some issues with farmed salmon, which is your Atlantic salmon that you're seeing in stores, mainly pollution. Some of these Atlantic salmon are even raised along the coasts in the Pacific Ocean, and those Atlantic salmon are escaping and intermingling with wild Pacific populations and spreading disease and whatnot. So we ask people to choose wild-caught salmon instead of farm-raised salmon.
Okay, so that's something we have to look for on the label. What else?
Well, there's also a very popular fish as of late called Chilean sea bass, which you'll see in a lot of higher-end restaurants, which has a nice mild flavor. It's very popular with the chefs. However, we're finding that there's a huge illegal trade of this fish. It's a fish that, again, is long-lived. That means the female fish, they don't even reach sexual maturity until they're about 10 years old. They can live to about 35 years and up. So now you have this fish that we're actually taking out of the water before they're reaching their sexual maturity. So the population just can't keep up with fishing. So the population size is dwindling. So that's one problem. The other problem is they're using hooks and lines that are catching endangered seabirds like albatross. And there are a lot of countries out there that are taking the fish illegally, and it's making it into our country. So there's actually a campaign out there called Take a Pass on Chilean Sea Bass that's asking chefs around the country to take a pass, really, and just not serve it anymore. And I believe there's about 60 restaurants in the San Francisco area alone who have already taken it off their menu.
Mm-hmm. What about canned tuna?
There's actually a better choice when you're looking at canned tuna. You can usually see two different types. You can see white or albacore tuna in a can, or you can see chunk light or light tuna. The better choice there is albacore. Albacore tuna or white tuna is caught using long lines. That means they're really targeting tuna and pelagic fish. Light tuna, that could be anything from yellowfin, it could be skipjack tuna, and they use a large net method that kind of encircles a school of fish to catch those products. However, they're also catching other species. They could be catching mammals. They can be catching sharks. They can be catching just a myriad of other species that are being taken, and then for the most part, released overboard as bycatch.
So that means that essentially they've killed them off.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, so white albacore tuna, don't eat Chilean sea bass, and think twice about Atlantic salmon that's raised on a farm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Lynn.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Jennifer D'Anto is program manager of Seafood Watch at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Jennifer left us some other reliable sources to check. You can find them all on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's it for this week, everybody. Thanks for being with us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this little bit of wisdom. Artificial intelligence is no match for natural stupidity. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And check out the Splendid Table store while you're at it. You're going to find it right there on our homepage. And I swear I have tasted everything on the site. And there's new stuff all the time. And all the proceeds go to support the show. Our program is produced by Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.